proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Jeff Bauer on behalf of appellant Edith Deck. On behalf of Ms. Deck, we have raised 5 points on appeal, which obviously because of time we won't be able to reach today. What I would like to speak with the court about is in regard to this court's opportunity to both construe the statute as well as to consider the constitutionality of the statute 490, 715, and the 2005 revisions to same under the right to trial by jury. In the Klotz case, this court did briefly touch upon the interpretation of the statute and held that it was a rebuttable presumption and not an irrebuttable presumption. The court has not yet had the opportunity to consider the constitutionality of the statute as it relates to the right to trial by jury. The court could decide this case on the statutory interpretation ground if it finds that the trial court incorrectly interpreted the statute and found it an irrebuttable presumption.
Does the judge act as a gatekeeper, or does submit the whole thing to the jury, whether or not it's on instruction, whether it's on a presumption, irrebuttable presumption, and let the jury decide for itself? It is an issue of damages, which the jury is well able to decide.
Yes, sir, Your Honor. And in fact, we would contend that it's not only an issue that the jury is well entitled or is well able to decide, that it is a matter that is solely committed to the determination of the jury. Under a long line of cases, that the amount of damages has historically been something that the jury is the one who decides. There's case law, I think the Steinberg case, I believe, from 1867 holds that it is not for the trial court to weigh evidence, and especially weigh conflicting evidence, as to the amount of damages and make a determination. Instead, that is something from the 1820 adoption of the Missouri Constitution on, which has been committed solely to the jury. And the provision is it shall remain inviolate, i.e., it may not be changed. And so in this case, it's not a gatekeeper provision. It is a provision where the trial court hears contested evidence. In this case, heard contested evidence from three separate witnesses, heard the evidence, and then made a factual determination as to the value of Ms. Edith Deck's past medical damages.
You don't have any question. The legislature could have said, no evidence can be introduced to establish the value of medical treatment other than the amount that was actually paid.
I think there are two issues there. One, the legislature actually considered that statute and rejected that and instead adopted the statute that we have today that has a rebuttable presumption. The second one is, since that is not the statute, I've not analyzed the specific constitutionality of it.
Well, you can see that the legislature can enact statutes that regulate the admission of evidence.
Yes, sir. The one question I would say would be, I know there are several courts which have considered, and that's actually an issue that was raised in the briefing by the respondent. They talked about the other states that have similar statutes. Those states generally fall under two types of provisions. The first provision has the legislature allows everything into evidence. They allow in the amount billed, and they also allow in the fact that there was a collateral source and this is what was paid, and the jury then considers it. The second provision is where the amount of bills incurred is let into evidence, and then after the jury makes their factual constitutional trial finding, the trial judge is then tasked with looking at the issue of what collateral sources were paid and then potentially deducting. That is not the process in this case. However, in those cases, the Johnson case out of Arkansas, one of the Kansas cases we cite in our brief, the Sheward case from Ohio, those courts, depending on the way that the language of the statute was adopted, did find those may violate other provisions of the Constitution. That is, though, not the statute that the legislature passed in this case.
Was this an evidentiary statute or something else?
Well, that's a good question, Your Honor. It is. That's the problem we've got with this statute is, and I think the Missouri practice, Judge Meehan and Judge Durker in their section this year cited that. What they said was that really the effect of the statute as it's passed has simply been to sow confusion among the trial courts because nobody exactly knows what this means.
Well, why isn't this just like any other statute that deals with the admissibility of evidence as a policy consideration by the legislature? For example, the rape shield statute. determines, changed the law regarding admissibility. And that didn't affect the right to jury trial. It just, as a matter of policy, it changed the policy as it relates to the admissibility of certain types of evidence. And all this does is really tighten the type of evidence that the court can consider as to what the reasonable value of the services is. We've traditionally, all the way back to 1820, let judges decide what was admissible concerning what the reasonable value of the services are. And the judge still gets to decide in this case. He could decide it's the whole thing. He could decide it's just what's been paid or somewhere in between.
And if I understand what your Honor is asking, I would disagree slightly with it, respectfully. And here is why. Because from 1820 on, the amount of damages has always been a jury question. This is not a statute where they said, I believe Judge Price talked about, we're going to adopt a statute that substantively the measure of damages is X. This is more akin to if you were to adopt a statute that says we're going to hold an evidentiary hearing in who had green light cases. And we're going to have the judge hear the testimony of all the witnesses and determine which he finds is credible and then only allow the testimony the judge finds credible before the jury.
Think about it this way. Would you agree with me the law regarding what's admissible for lost profits has changed over the years? In other words, the standards have loosened and the trial judge is in charge of that, and it goes along with what's maybe evolved as to what's really relevant to try to prove damages. So in that instance, people weren't denied the right to a jury trial on lost profits. It's just that the law has evolved such that maybe the admissibility of the type of evidence that we would receive now is maybe a looser standard than what had been in previous. And this just kind of tightens the standards regarding admissibility.
And I believe that goes back to Judge Price's issue, because the collateral source rule has substantive and procedural benefits, substantive and procedural aspects to it. And in this case, the legislature did not make a procedural change. Instead, the legislature specifically said the issue to be determined is still the same issue that it has always been, which is what is the value of past medical damage.
Does the court have here you're saying the court thought it couldn't consider anything but what was actually paid. Mm-hmm. But what are you saying is the proper standard? Does the court have some gatekeeper role in deciding what the jury hears?
In regards to the interpretation of the statute, putting aside the constitutional challenge, and I think those are two separate issues in this case. One is, what evidence did the trial court have before it? And that's it simply misinterpreted the statute, in which case the court could have decided on that. The second aspect is, apart from that, if the court did interpret it, does it violate the trial by jury?
Well, go ahead and finish.
In regard to the interpretation of the statute, the statute says that it shall consider things such as the bills incurred, and goes through a list, and it's a non-inclusive list. In this, and the other part of that is that the statute specifically adopted the term rebuttable presumption.
Non-inclusive or non-exclusive?
I'm sorry?
Say non-inclusive or non-exclusive.
I said non-exclusive. It listed three statutory categories. It said including but not limited to.
Well,
so in regard...
Let me interrupt you there with that. When you talk about a rebuttable presumption, the statute in that sentence is speaking to the judge. We don't tell juries about rebuttable presumptions. God knows it's enough that a judge can't understand what a rebuttable presumption is. But it says, in determining the value of the medical treatment rendered, there shall be a rebuttable presumption of the dollar amount, et cetera. Now, the who is missing here. Who is to determine the value of the medical treatment rendered? And it squares your argument if it's the jury that's going to determine the value of the medical treatment rendered. The statute tells the judge that it's a rebuttable presumption, which may have something to do with how the judge tells the jury what its job is.
And that would be consistent with the cases on rebuttable presumption where the right to trial by jury exists. The Union Electric versus Brown case we cited had to do with rebuttable presumption of negligence in an electrical case. In that case, and the courts have consistently held, once you introduce any evidence to rebut the presumption, then the matter goes to the trier of fact, i.e. the jury.
And if there's no evidence, then the jury is then the only evidence, if there's no evidence other than what the provider was paid, then that's what the evidence that the jury has. But it allows introduction that the evidence of evidence to the effect that the value of the services was different from what the provider paid.
Yes, sir, Your Honor. Once contrary evidence is submitted, the rule of law and the established meaning of rebuttable presumption that is presumed to go with the statute is the presumption vanishes because it is not evidence, and then the matter is decided solely based on the evidence before
it. But it says the court decides it. I'm sorry.
Well, go ahead, Laura.
It says the court, upon motion of the party, the court shall
determine. At a hearing, yes, Your Honor.
And are you saying that?
I'm saying that aspect of the statute is what makes it unconstitutional because it is the jury who is tasked with determining contested issues of fact as to the value of what plaintiff's damages are.
Let me suggest a reading to you, and you tell me what's wrong with it.
I hesitate to do that, but I will try, Your Honor.
Well, on 490, get down to 5-1. 5-1 says parties can introduce evidence. It's a standard evidentiary requirement. Legislature can do that. That the value of medical treatment is the value of medical treatment was that reasonable, necessary, and proximate. That's what gets in. Then it says in determining that there's a rebuttable presumption of the dollar amount necessary, and the judge shall look at any evidence you want. Why isn't two a subset of one? You know, one, we're saying this is an evidentiary rule. Two, it's what they paid. Or if you don't think that's right, the judge can determine. And then that's what's admissible. Why isn't this just an evidentiary statute they get to do?
And if I understand Your Honor's reading of the statute, what you're saying is the second step, once the presumption is rebutted, the trial court is the one who hears the contested evidence.
Well, they hear the contested evidence relative to the evidence that would be admissible to the jury.
In other words, the evidence on the presumption of whether or not it is rebutted. If the trial court hears the issue of has this presumption been rebutted and then makes that determination and passes off then to the jury the determination of what the value is based on that, then that would potentially be constitutional. Unfortunately, the way the trial court interpreted it in this case was that the trial court is the one who makes the determination based on this contested evidence of what is the value, i.e. the ultimate past medical damage.
Well, I'm kind of saying that it is the trial court's obligation here to determine what evidence the jury hears. The jury then makes its own determination of damages. But the judge, subsection 2, says the judge determines what evidence they hear under 1.
And I think the reason is because, Your Honor, typically and historically from the 1820 period on when the Constitution was adopted, the determination of the value was the past medical damage. That was the issue that the jury decided. And so rather than making this an evidentiary standard, it is instead a contested issue of fact, which historically is reserved solely for the jury.
You're out of time, but did you want to refer to your exhibit?
I did, if I could, for just a moment, Your Honor.
Let me ask one question, and you can answer with reference to that.
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
If the judge determined that the evidence under this statute, that he thought it was okay to introduce the whole bill, the jury would still be free to believe all part or none of that testimony. In other words, if the judge said, I think the fairest way to do this is let it all in, you could offer your bills and he could say, but this is all that's been paid. How would that violate the right to trial by jury, if that's what the trial judge decided?
It would not, because it follows the substantive law of what Missouri is. This statute does not change the substantive law, i.e. that you're allowed to recover for the value of what the medical care is, and the jury makes that determination.
So what you're saying is that the constitutional way to read this statute is that the court considers this evidence, but then simply lets the jury hear it.
If the court were determined that it was possible to sever that portion of the statute, I would agree that if the court hears the issue of the rebuttability of the presumption and determines the presumption has been rebutted, then it goes before the jury.
So you're in effect saying the legislature does not have any authority to enact evidentiary standards for admission of medical evidence.
No, I'm certainly not. I'm not arguing that. What I'm saying is this is not an evidentiary standard statute. This is instead a statute which takes the issue of the contested medical damages and allows the trial court to make that factual determination. And so I think that is the difference. If the court, and I believe this goes back to Judge Price's argument about making a substantive rule as far as what the measure of recovery is, or making a substantive rule as to what elements are recoverable, that wasn't done. The statute continues to follow the common law rule that the value of medical services are what is recoverable. That has been the standard.
How do you read May in that sentence that we're concerned about? Upon motion of any party, the court may determine outside the value of the medical. Now, if I'm a judge and I'm reading the right to trial by jury, I say, well, I may do that, but then again, I may not, because I think it's something that should go to the jury.
It appears that it may make it discretionary whether the trial court holds such a hearing. In this case, the trial judge did hold the hearing, heard the contested evidence from the witnesses, and then made the factual determination.
Because it doesn't say shall.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So, do you want to explain your poster?
Yeah, real quick, and I'm sorry, I appreciate the indulgence, Your Honors. This has to do with the first point, which is whether the trial court adopted and considered the issue of value correctly. And the reason is that in this case we had Ms. Deck, who was injured, who had $27,900 of medical bills incurred, and because she was paid, those bills were paid by Medicare, which is, according to the testimony, done to be value neutral under the federal budget. The amount that was paid was only a little under $10,000. And the argument here is that, and this is why the courts have had such trouble interpreting what value means, because if you have three people in the same accident in this case instead of one, they all had the same injury, they all saw the same doctor, and they all had the same care, the trial court's determination of the way he adopted the statute meant the value, not how much they were out, because that's not the question, but the value of the services they received would be different for each individual depending on whether they had no insurance, where they received the full amount of $27,000 billed. If they had Medicare, they would only receive $9,900. Or if they had private health insurance, which had a negotiated rate of $17,000, they would only receive.
And you're saying the value to the person who received the services has to be the same in all three instances?
Yes, Your Honor. How can the value be different? Because the statute certainly could have said the issue we're looking at is how much out-of-pocket someone is, which was the original.
But there's no determination. When Medicare pays, they don't say this is the value. They just say this is what we're going to pay.
That's exactly right. And that was the testimony.
I don't care what the value is. We're just paying you this amount. There's nothing related to the value.
And that was
the
testimony.
I don't think you have to convince him of that.
Oh, okay.
I like and the color. That was the testimony of our expert that the Medicare rate is not set on value. It is set solely on the issue of budget neutrality. And my time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Very colorful.
As one who is on Medicare, I must say I'm a little distressed by this.
As of April 1st.
Brand new.
May it please the court. Jason Coatney for Mr. Teasley. 497.15 is an attempt by the legislature to reconcile two competing policies. You have the policy that damages and tort are to be compensatory only, and that a tortfeasor should not benefit from a collateral source. In this case, Ms. Deck was allowed to present evidence to the jury for the debt she incurred, which was $9,000, $904.28. It was not $27,991.
But that's not the issue. It's the value. Isn't it the value she's entitled to recover, not the debt?
Yes, ma'am. But the debt she incurred, I would argue, establishes the value of the procedure.
That's not what the statute says.
Well, I think that
the jury might find it does, but it lets her put in other evidence of it, too. It doesn't make it a conclusive. You're saying it is an irrebuttable presumption.
No, I think it's rebuttable. I think that the chart shows you that there are several different values that are placed on it from the hospital as they send the bills out the door. But the person who testified from the hospital in this case stated that they knew that it did not matter what number they ascribed as the bill left the hospital. They knew they were only going to get a certain amount of money for the procedures that were performed from Medicare. So they could say.
But if they put a lien on the person, if someone has more money than that and they wanted to get the money somewhere else from a lien on their house or something else. They certainly have a assertable right. Once they get paid a portion by Medicare, they have an assertable right on taking a lien on the person's house or doing something else to collect the full value of the services rendered.
I think that the state of the law, Your Honor, is that when Medicare pays the money, the debt's gone. There's no person who is ever going to collect the difference between the $27,000 and the $9,000. The hospital won't be able to collect it. No insurance company will be able to collect it.
So can the person with no insurance sue the hospital for fraud or theft? That's the effect of your argument is, by definition, that has no necessary relation to the services performed.
Well, I think that there's been some discussion about that in the legal communities about whether there is some antitrust issues in that. But the point is that the legislature was recognizing the varying degrees of medical service provided for someone. As Mr. Bauer receives a procedure, and then I receive the same procedure, but because of my status financially, I'm charged a different amount, or I'm obliged to pay back a different amount.
Can you address opposing parties' argument that the legislature did not say you can show what you're out of pocket, or maybe out of pocket if there's a lien against you, but instead it said the value? Under your interpretation, that might be a very logical way for the legislature to go, but here they just created a presumption that what you were out of pocket was the value, but let you prove otherwise. And I don't see where you're letting the person put in evidence that it could be something more.
You're talking about from the plaintiff's perspective.
That's what we're saying, what the plaintiff can submit as evidence. So when it says it's a rebuttable presumption and the court can consider evidence of other things, including the medical bills and so forth. So clearly the legislature thought those may be relevant for the jury's consideration. But if I understand, the court here said that once we find out what you paid, that's it.
The problem with that, I believe, Your Honor, would be that the jury hearing that kind of evidence violates the collateral source rule.
I'm not getting into the jury issue right now, but you're basically saying whatever you paid, that's it.
I'm sorry, ma'am?
You're basically saying whatever you paid, that's it, and it would be inappropriate to put in evidence mm-hmm. of what the bill was, this $27,000. Or the court couldn't rely on that, aren't you?
What I'm saying, ma'am, is that if the plaintiff is allowed to present testimony or evidence that she incurred $27,000 in medical bills, that is a fiction. That is not true. There's no time that she was ever going to be obliged to pay this amount of money. And for the defendant to
go ahead.
How do we know that? What if she did not submit the bills to Medicare?
I think that any person over the age of 65 must.
They must do that? Is that a statutory requirement?
I believe they have to come within Medicare.
Well, I know they can do that, and they would commonly do that, but what if she just didn't?
Well, if they decide not to be part of Medicare.
I'm sorry, Judge?
What if they decide not to be part of Medicare?
Right.
I'm not certain that a person over 65 has that option.
I'm pretty sure you don't have to submit your bill.
Well, I suppose then that would be she could present that evidence to the court to rebut the presumption of the value of medical bills.
But again, the legislature didn't say you got to prove what you paid or how much you're out. Because as you've noted, that it said what's the value of it. That the point is that tortfeasor is not supposed to benefit from the fact that you may have insurance or not. You're supposed to get recompense the value of the harm to you, of which the bills or what you actually paid is evidence, and strong evidence, which the jury may well find absolutely dispositive. But why can't you put in evidence that, in fact, the injury had a greater value?
Well, I suppose the purpose of something like that would be for a layperson to say, well, the injury must be much more severe if the damages are $27,000 versus $9,000. But that's not really the proper way for a litigant to present evidence of injury to a jury.
Well, yet you said it well. You said for the jury to determine damages.
Yes, sir.
That's their job, is to determine damages, not necessarily and with it is the value, but the damages. And if you look at Judge Wolf's decision in the Deal case, unanimous decision regarding the right to juries inviolate, and also I think it's the New Horizon case, in which in the Merchandising Practices Act, they said the court will determine the damages, and we decided that that would be unconstitutional. It has to be the jury.
I'm not certain that Deal versus O'Malley would be dispositive here, Your Honor. I think that, that's a question of equity versus damages. It's our contention that the jury is determining the damages here, but the judge is being a gatekeeper trying to determine what evidence will be presented to the jury.
But the legislature's put there could be a disagreement here, obviously, but the legislature's determining that the jury should be a gatekeeper. Can they do that as opposed to the Constitution of Missouri?
I think that consistently, prior to the passage of the Constitution 1820, that the judges have been gatekeepers of what evidence would be presented to the jury.
In this particular case, then, would the judge, as part of the verdict form or the verdict instructions, would he say, I instruct you that the value of the medical services rendered was $9,904?
In terms of the evidence that's received for the jury, I think that has to be the case.
Well, how did the judge instruct in this case?
I'm sorry, how did he instruct?
How did the judge instruct?
I believe Mr.
Your Honor, if I might, because I tried the case and prepared on the evidentiary issues, it was not instructed in that manner. It was simply admitted into evidence that this is the value, this is the amount of medical expenses incurred by the plaintiff, and that was argued to the jury. There was not a specific instruction that set that forth.
What if the trial judge would have said, I've read this statute, it says may, and as far as I'm concerned, all these things are relevant, what the bill was and what actually got paid, and let the jury decide?
Well, I suppose the question at that point would be a violation of the collateral source rule.
Well, no, because we know that the collateral source doesn't come in. So if a trial judge just didn't want to be, I'm not going to say the trial judge being recalcitrant to the legislator's direction because they've said may. What if the trial judge said, so they said I may, but, you know, I've decided not to. And if the trial judge decides not to, we know that the statute says you're not allowed to admit collateral source evidence. How would the trial court have committed any error for failing to do a may?
Well, I'm not sure I exactly understand.
Well,
it
says upon a motion of the parties, and then it says what the trial court may do to rebut this rebuttable presumption. You know, and the thought process looks like the legislature intended trial judges to figure out what they thought a fair value of the services was based upon what was actually paid or what the people might owe. In some of these cases where there isn't Medicare and there is insurance, people have signed agreements, as sometimes you have to do in real life in order to get care. You have to promise to pay because maybe the doctor isn't a preferred provider and you can't find anybody to provide your medical care to preferred providers. So it looks like they're saying the trial judge, at a minimum, if the trial judge wants to, it looks like he can wade in here and give a number that he thinks is a reasonable value. But if the trial judge says may means may, and I've decided not to wade in, and the statute says there's no collateral source, aren't you left to just argue then what the reasonable value of the services are, just as you would have been prior to the enactment of this statute?
Well, I believe with the reading of the may being interpreted that way, yes.
How could may be interpreted other than the way I suggest?
Well, in the context of this case, the argument that we've advanced all along is that under the standards of the statute as set forth in the second paragraph,
mm-hmm.
which is not addressed in the appellant's brief regarding the issue of the rebuttable presumption, that in that instance there's substantial evidence to establish value, and in the context of this case, that evidence is uncontroverted and conclusive, and that's consistent with the Klotz opinion of this court, which speaks specifically of substantial evidence that existed. In that case, there was substantial evidence that there were amounts of, that obligated the
above
plaintiff appellant above and beyond.
But you're saying value is limited automatically to what you owe. And why is that the case? Why did the legislature didn't say what you paid or what they're going to make you pay? It says the value of it, which may be different, may be the same.
Well, the statute states that, first of all, that there is a rebuttable presumption of the financial obligations to
right.
the health care
providers.
But
it's rebuttable, so it may be something more.
It may be something more than what's paid. As held
and what
in
you paid is good evidence of what it's worth, but you may have evidence that it was worth more. That it had a greater value.
Correct. And in this case, there was not that evidence. The evidence in this specific case simply was that the amount paid was $9,904.
Well, wasn't
that's because the counsel was not allowed to present to the jury the witnesses as to what the what other values of the services were.
Because they said the $27,000 was reasonable and necessary. I can't remember the language, but the language in here was reasonable customary medical expenses, wasn't it? Or reasonable customary charges. But the jury was not allowed to hear that. So that was additional evidence of value. If they had evidence saying these were reasonable and customary charges for the service performed.
Well, I think you're going into the constitutional question here and
well, beyond the constitutional question, as Judge Fisher alluded to, it's a very common occurrence that someone will have injuries and they need a doctor who could provide the skilled care they need, but they're not in the network. So maybe the insurance company will pay 20% of the value, and that's what they'll pay. And the rest of it, you're required to pay. So, I mean, if you're going to have this, the amount paid is still from your private insurance, leave out Medicare. But your private insurance pays only 20%. And you've got to pay the rest, but the only amount paid is still, but you're still obligated to pay the rest.
And that's a different case with different evidence right. than the case that we had in this.
I agree with you on that. So here's my point. Did the trial judge, and did the trial judge in this case erroneously determine that he had to limit the damages in this case because it was agreed that there was no financial obligation above what was already paid?
I don't believe that he erroneously determined that because that gets into the issue raised by appellant of irrebuttable presumption, if I understand the question. And in this case, there was every bit of evidence that was offered by the plaintiff appellant that was considered by the court. And if you look at the court's ruling in its entirety and not in the snippets that are advanced by the appellant, it's clear that the evidence, the testimony of the former administrator was considered, his testimony about that billing being arbitrary was considered, and the trial court, based on that evidence and then based on the evidence of the custodians of the health care providers showing the amount paid and the fact that there was no obligation beyond that, made that decision in accordance with the evidence before him. And so our point has been all along that regarding the rebuttable presumption, it was within the discretion of the trial court to make that determination. And within the statutory construction argument that he interpreted and applied the statute in a correct and proper manner as it was written.
So in your reading of it, the trial judge, in which you're said, telling us what the trial judge did, was that he made a factual finding. He considered the evidence of other ways of valuing it, and he said, in my view, this is what it is, $9,904.
I would say he made a finding in accordance with the collateral source rule, which is stated to be the title of that statute, collateral source rule modified, and so he made a determination so that a value amount was admitted to the jury in concert with.
Let me make the question more direct. That is a determination of a factual question. What is the value of this service is a factual question, not a legal question. Not a question of law, it's a question of fact.
I'm not sure I would agree with that in the context of this statute, considering the title of the statute, considering the fact that the collateral source rule is what is stated to be augmented here. I think that...
Well, if it's not a question of fact, what is it?
I, I think you could make the argument it's a question of or a determination of fact. I'm not sure I necessarily agree with that under these circumstances.
But the fact as to the value of damages was not submitted to the jury, so the jury didn't determine that question of fact. Is that correct?
They didn't determine. What happened in this case was they were given a number as to the medical expenses.
So they didn't make a factual finding as to the value of the damages because that was given to them rather than they decided.
Well, I would say I would say that they made a determination as to the value of damages. Yes, because damages were argued above and beyond the medical expenses in this case. There was evidence relating to the plaintiff appellant's pain and suffering and things that went well beyond just the medical expenses. So the jury in this case did make a determination as to damages. In fact, the jury verdict was $42,000, not $9,904.
I'm getting confused, and I wonder if you can help me. It seems to me our rule of liability forever has been that you're entitled to collect your damages, correct? I mean, the word we use is damages. We equate damages with what you've paid. We don't do it by value, right?
And I would agree.
Value is a concept that is apart from the traditional way we would look at this in any respect. What are we doing in this statute talking about values instead of damages? Aren't we mixing and matching terms in a way that's somewhat unfamiliar to us?
Well, I think you've addressed the thing that we have not discussed yet here today, and that is the application of this statute to, so that it is in concert with the rule of compensatory damages and to prevent a recovery of windfall damages. And under the arguments advanced by the appellant in this case and under the facts in this case, you're talking about a windfall damages award when you talk about an amount that the appellant plaintiff has not paid and is never obligated to pay. When you talk about the difference between the amount billed, which was $29,000 some odd, and the amount that was actually paid with no obligations remaining of $9,904.
I guess what I'm saying is, does Section 5.2 have any meaning at all in the way we traditionally look at tort law? Does it? I mean, they talk about all these values. And it talks about in determining the value of medical treatment, the necessary amount to satisfy the financial obligation shall be the value. So what? Does that do anything with our regular way of submitting to juries that you're supposed to find damages?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
I'm pretty sure I don't. That's my problem.
I guess right. Judge Durker was right. It was designed to sow confusion.
Yeah, there you go. All right. I'm sorry. Yeah, if you can.
Or anybody else out there.
Thank you. What I would suggest is that what it does is it fixes the problem that's created in 497.15.1, which is if I'm the defendant and I say I'm going to pay your medical bills, and then I'm going to tell the jury that your medical bills have been paid. Well, what is the number that we tell the jury for what the bills were?
Well, I get that's the idea, but looking at the language they've used relative to the language that we've always used, the language is apples and oranges language. I mean, you can cobble it together maybe, but it just...
And I think that's the legislature trying to deal with what Mr. Bowers alluded to here. There's actually two things missing. You also have veterans benefits and Medicaid benefits.
Sure.
So you have five different values of what they call medical services. But the point is that they're trying to get to what the damages are, what the actual number is that the plaintiff is obliged to pay, make sure that is submitted to the jury so that the the defendant has a right to a fair trial as well. They're not going to be given a fair trial, equal protection of the laws, if they're hamstrung and a piece of duct tape put over their mouth by saying, well, you're not going to be able to tell the jury that this person actually only had to pay $9,000. They're going to be able to submit that it was $27,000, and you know, the jury is going to hear that those medical bills were paid, but as a measure to inflate the injuries that somebody sustained, it's sexier, if you will, by saying that it was $27,000 versus $9,000.
I got one question.
Oh,
I know. Could the trial judge have looked at this statute and merely said, it says may and I'm not going to?
I think in the current context of prior to whatever this court decides, that there may be a lot of judges out there who do that. I know
this judge didn't, but...
There was a case in Greene County a couple weeks ago where the judge allowed the jury to hear
everything,
what was actually billed. In that case, as I understand it, it was $600,000 bill, but Medicare paid $200,000. So you have a windfall for this plaintiff, if they're successful in front of the jury, of $400,000.
Well, you don't know what a windfall is. I mean, you know, that's the whole problem, is real damages is what you pay. The collateral source rule is you don't get to put in that I have insurance. Well, is it what I paid or what I was billed or who knows? So thank you very much,
sure,
counsel.
We'll give you a shot at answering the questions now.
I'll take a shot at the question, Your Honor, I ask in regard to why it talks about value. And the reason is prior Missouri substantive law in regard to past medical damages talked about the value. One of the things that was recoverable was the reasonable value.
As a matter of foundation.
Yes, and substantively that was typically shown by the fact that the amount was billed. The collateral source rule then had a substantive and procedural aspect to it. That's the Long versus Missouri Delta case. There are other cases that talk about value in the law. One of the cases we cited was Atterbury versus Atterbury on rebuttable presumptions. And in that case, it had to do with the value of support that a wife paid while she was married was recoverable. And the court held that in a rebuttable presumption situation like that, if you rebut the presumption, the matter then goes to the jury to determine what the value of those services are. So value does have substantive history in Missouri law on damages. And so our argument is, and I think it's consistent with the case law, is the statute merely confirmed what the rule has always been, that it's value. However, it set up a procedure to determine that contested issue. The one thing I wanted to address
You think that it's an issue of fact?
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
The statute assigned for the judge to make the determination of an issue of fact.
That is correct, Your Honor. The one thing I do want to address that I didn't get a chance to was in regard to the court's interpretation of the statute. The court indicated that it was deciding the matter based on the presumption, and the court held that the presumption had not been rebutted. Now, there's been some discussion briefly by respondent as to what evidence, that there wasn't any evidence. I would disagree with that, and here's why. One, there was an affidavit similar to the Barra case from the Eastern District, which has ruled on this issue, where the medical provider indicated that the reasonable, necessary value of these bills was what they submitted as incurred, not what they eventually took due to a reduction in Medicare. The providers both testified that the value was what was billed, not what they eventually took from Medicare. And our expert testified in regard to Medicare that Medicare has never said that they are the value of the damage, or pardon me, the value of the bills. Instead, it is done for a completely separate reason, which is budget neutrality. And he gave the example of the 2009 budget that overall there was a 12% reduction in Medicare rates, not because the value of Medicare or medical services had gone down by 12% from 2008 to 2009. Instead, it was projected that Medicare would have higher costs because more people would be seeking services, and therefore they arbitrarily cut it 12%.
But if the medical professional takes the Medicare or Medicaid, then they can't ask for anything more?
Well, that is correct typically, Your Honor. However, they're not allowed to negotiate with Medicare. Medicare simply tells them, here's the amount you must take based on our decision of budget neutrality, not value, which is not what the statute calls for. And my time is up, Your Honors. Thank you very much.